Hey there, and welcome to episode number 162 of Marvel by the Month, the Eisner Award-nominated recommended podcast that takes you through the history of Marvel Comics 1 month at a time. And this episode, that month is August 1971. My name is Brian Stratton.
Mine is Rob Milne.
And mine is Jamie Wenger.
Fellas, this is a big month of Marvel Comics. I mean, literally. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it figuratively and literally. Every single issue this month ballooned from like an average of about 19 pages to up around like 33, 34, 35 pages. And the price increased from 15 cents to 25 cents. And this is also the month where six of Marvel's titles had 25 cent annuals on the stands because we're, you know, right in the middle of summer. And it's also a big month because it's Marvel's 10th anniversary. Fantastic Four number one hit the stands in August 1961, which kicked off the Marvel Age of Comics. And here we are in August 1971. So we've made it a solid decade.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. That's a percentage, right? Of the grand total.
Yes, it is a percentage.
Yeah. it's like 1/6.
Yeah, exactly. Like that. Well, that voice you hear coming through your headphones is our guest for this week. It was such a big month for Marvel. There was only one guest that we could bring on to do this justice. Frankly, I am as surprised as everyone else that he continues to accept these invitations. I'm so glad that he does. We are delighted to welcome back to the show Marvel Comics Senior Vice President of Publishing and Executive Editor Tom Brevoort.
Welcome.
There was only one big enough, and by big enough, I mean round enough for this episode, and that is me. I am happy to be here and to contribute spherical information.
Excellent. Okay. Well, Tommy, it's so great to have you back for such a big month of Marvel Comics. Marvel is, they're celebrating their 10th birthday in the Bullpen and Bulletins this month. Stan Lee has recently gone on hiatus, like as of, I think, the last month. The comics are almost twice the size, almost twice the price, but that only holds for 1 month. and then it goes back, the page count and the price both come down, but they don't go back down all the way to where they were before. There's talk also in this month's Bullpen Bulletins about merging Daredevil and Iron Man into a single book, which doesn't actually happen. So what the heck is going on?
Well, there were a lot of things going on, and actually I've heard people talk about this, and you know, even historians have said like this is a super clever moment where Marvel publisher Martin Goodman faints that they're going to do this and then reverses course. And you know, that's the thing that finally puts Marvel over the top and beats, you know, DC or National in sales for the first time. And that's not, it's not untrue, but it's as far as I can tell, it was a lot less planned than that. Mm-hmm. You know, the first thing that was happening at this time, leading up to this time, is that there was a shrinkage of sales in comics big time. The superhero boom and the superhero fad that really reached its zenith with the Batman TV show and the aftermath of that had really cooled off. And so once you get to about 1968, the numbers on everything start plummeting. And in addition, there's a real problem in that the switch over from little mom and pop, you know, candy stores and smoke shops and whatnot to more larger organized chains of stores, your 7-Elevens and the like, means that a lot of these places, a lot of the venues for comics were disappearing. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason that they were disappearing, or at least the popular theory at the time, was basically they weren't pulling their weight, that you weren't making as much revenue on the space having a comic book rack because the cover price was so low that, you know, on a 15 cent comic book, you were making pennies.
Yeah.
And you had to make a lot of pennies in that space. Whereas if you put, you know, whatever, another rack of candy there, you still were making pennies, but you were making more pennies.
Right.
And so once we hit August, and this started a few months earlier, DC raised their prices to 25 cents like 2 months earlier. And they went up to a 52 page package, which was really 48 pages plus cover, but they touted it as 52.
Yeah.
and basically they filled out the rest of the magazine with reprints. Mm-hmm. So you still got however much, you know, 24 pages of new DC editorial content and about 16 pages of stuff from their vaults. They had years and years of comics that they could reprint. Because they had done all stuff that was shorter in page length, it was easy to drop in, mm-hmm. 16 pages, in any particular title and be able to find something that at least vaguely would go along with what you were doing. Like, it wasn't tough to fill up the back pages of, Batman. And if you happen to need to fill up the back pages of Forever People, there were plenty of other Jack Kirby stories that you could put there or whatever. Like, so they'd been doing this by this point for about 2 months. Mm-hmm. And Marvel decided that they would follow suit. Again, people over the years have speculated that this was a coordinated effort, that everybody decided they were going to do this. And from what I can see, it was not. Mm-hmm. It was an independent effort, and it was an attempt by everybody to kind of, stem the tide of this thing. The 25-cent package was, for a second, seen as this is the future of comics. We have to go back to when they were big, in the golden age, they were 64 pages. You got a lot of value for your money. That we need to go back to that package solely so that each individual release will generate more income. That if you're talking about, well, you only make pennies. Well, now maybe you make a nickel. Maybe mm-hmm. you make 6 cents. And that will help justify keeping the rack space in those outlets that are slowly drifting away.
Mm-hmm. And if you're a kid at that point and you're picking up a comic and a percentage of it is reprint, that's not like a dirty word the way it became a little bit later. You're like, oh my God, this is awesome. I get to see what happens.
It depends on which kid you are. So for some kids, yes. And for some kids, no. It's the same problem that we face these days and why things like anthologies are such a hard sell. Mm-hmm. Everybody, if you question fans today, they'll all tell you, we love anthologies. Anthologies are great. They're the best thing ever. And you put it out in an anthology, you literally just put out a book with a backup strip. And a bunch of readers show up going, I didn't want to spend X mm-hmm. amount of money for a backup strip. I had a very weird experience with this. Now it's about 10 years ago. We had a price increase. I think it was the price increase that took us to $2.99. Mm-hmm. And a bunch of our books, we decided to add content to it. We added like 8-page or 10-page stories. But we didn't do this with every single book, but we did it with a bunch of them. In Avengers, we ended up doing, it was the oral history of the Avengers, and Brian Bendis wrote it.
Oh, yeah.
And in Captain America, we did Nomad. I had done a Nomad limited series with the Bucky Barnes from the Heroes Reborn universe, and we carried that over. And like clockwork, every letter we got, every communication, every email was, why am I paying an extra 75 cents for this stuff I don't want? And with other books, we just increased the price and didn't add anything.
Right.
No letters complaining about it.
No one said a word. Oh, that's funny.
The minute we stopped, the minute we went, okay, we're going to finish the oral history and we're just not going to go forward anymore, Nomad, all that stopped. And nobody complained about the cover price. It was the perception of it that caused people to go, why am I paying my money for this thing I don't want?
That's so bizarre.
It is. And it doesn't make any sense, except it kind of does if you're a guy that's going to your comic shop, whatever age, and you've got 10 bucks to spend on your comics, and this one costs more now, and there's a part of it you just don't want. You'd rather have that money to spend on some other comic or some other thing. Mm-hmm. It is weird, I grant you, but I saw it up close and personal and consistent to the point where I can't deny the evidence. This is how enough of the audience felt that they were happier just going up. It's also the reason why DC's holding the line initiative that year, holding the line $2.99, did nothing for them other than slice a big chunk of their profit. Because everybody liked that in principle. Yes, we want our comics to be cheaper, But that didn't mean they were going to suddenly take the money that they were saving on a DC book versus a Marvel book and buy more DC books. People went into the stores and they bought the comics they wanted to buy. Mm-hmm. And if they wanted to buy Superman or Batman, they did. But they weren't more likely to than to buy Spider-Man or Daredevil. And, you know, if they, you know, decided that they didn't want Daredevil or couldn't afford Daredevil, that didn't make them suddenly go, I'm going to take that money and try Superman or Batman. They took that money and went home and spent it on the 3 million other things that you could have.
Right.
So, and again, eventually somebody at DC figured that out, much as we did with the backups and things, and went, you know what, maybe it's time we stop holding the line and charge the same price that has become now industry standard and get that extra couple of pennies and nickels for ourselves. And so that kind of leads us back to 1971. I think what happened studying it, staring at it, and I did a little just not investigating, but just kind of poking around and looking at the history in preparation for this. I think what happened was Martin Goodman very early on got initial sales reports back from his jobbers out in the industry, that the people who would monitor newsstands and see what was happening. Mm-hmm. And he found out very quickly that the DC books that had gone up to 25 cents were all starting to nosedive sales wise. And he went, holy crap.
We're,
you know, because you can see, we're only talking about August right now, but as you look into next month and the month after, they had at least another month's worth of oversized books prepared.
Yeah.
And all of those jobs had to be broken in half and serialized over two issues, and extra pages or extra little backups or reprints or whatever had to quickly be fudged. This wasn't something that was planned way out. This was a sudden, whoa, we're going over a cliff. Quick turn. Do the the one place where he was kind of clever, and the thing that did put Marvel over the top, is when they reduced the cover price back down from 25 cents to 20 cents. Mm-hmm. Martin basically gave a bigger percentage of that cover price to the retailer. Mm. So in essence, that guy made the same amount of profit on a 20 cent Marvel that he made on a 25 cent DC. Any kid that went to the comic book rack, was more likely to buy the cheaper book than the more expensive book. And that right there, I think, is the thing that allowed Marvel's sales to finally outdo DC sales. Because DC stuck with that 25 cent model for a year and a half, I think. It was a considerable amount of time. And by the time they realized, oh, this is not good, Marvel had made those strides and there was no catching up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whoa.
Thank you so much for that history lesson, Tom. Now I'm going to kick things over to Rob, who's going to start us off on another history lesson of what was going on in the world in August of 1971, where the comics that we're going to be talking about this episode were released. So, Rob, take it away.
All right. We'll start with comics news. The second annual Golden State Comic-Con, which would eventually be known as the San Diego Comic-Con, took place at Muir College in La Jolla, California. Official guests included Jack Kirby and Ray Bradbury, as well as Superman actor Kirk Allen, science fiction author and screenwriter Lee Brackett, and pulp sci-fi author Edmund Hamilton. An estimated 800 comics and sci-fi fans attended the three-day event.
800 people!
There were fewer than that on my hotel floor. San Diego now.
Yep.
Well, and that's up from like 300 or something at the last time.
Yeah, this is the biggest one they've had. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it's fun to watch it tick up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Charlton Comics launched a new suspense anthology titled Ghost Manor, which featured a 7-page story drawn by Steve Ditko. And DC debuted two new spooky series, Sinister House of Secret Love, which was basically SEO optimized with every buzzword in 1971 comics. Not to be confused with Dark Mansion of Forbidden Love, which launched last month.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm sure they got a lot of mail for the Sinister House of Secret Love. because how could they not? It was very confusing. The post office tried their best, but with addresses like that,
just don't know where to deliver this stuff. Spirit World Number One, an occult-themed comics anthology magazine published under the Hampshire Distributors imprint. Every story was written, drawn, and edited by Jack Kirby.
Cool.
Yeah.
On August 1st, the Sonny and Cher Comedy Hour, starring husband and wife singing duo Salvatore Sonny Bono and Sherilyn Cher LaPierre, premiered as a summer replacement series on the CBS network to run for 6 consecutive summer nights. The variety show is popular enough that it would be added to the CBS regular schedule in December.
Nice. And I've got Beatles by the Month on the same day. They're still alive. On the same day in New York City, 40,000 people attended the concert for Bangladesh, a pair of fundraising concerts organized by former Beatle George Harrison and Indian sitar player Ravi Shankar in order to raise money for UNICEF to provide humanitarian relief to refugees of Bangladesh. Other musical performers for the concerts at New York's Madison Square Garden were Ringo Starr, Bob Dylan, Eric Clapton, Billy Preston, Leon Russell, and the band Badfinger. Tagging onto this, August 71 saw the release of The Who's album Who's Next. Who didn't actually play until the fourth concert for Bangladesh, the fourth annual. But this album came out in August 71, featuring one of the great Keith Moon drumming performances on Baba O'Reilly, also known as that song with the sunglasses and scream from CSI.
No way.
This is Metal by the Month adjacent. I'm going to start trying to wedge in anything about the rise of heavy metal as we go forward. Yeah.
All right. Well, bless you. On the 2nd of August, 1971, U.S. Secretary of State William P. Rogers announced that the United States would support the entry of the People's Republic of China as a member of the United Nations, reversing a policy of almost 22 years of opposing representation by China's communist government in the UN. But Rogers also declared that the U.S. would oppose the expulsion from the UN of the Republic of China, which was based on the island of Taiwan, which had claimed to represent the interests of the world's most populous nation, even after being forced to abandon the mainland. So don't get your republics of China confused. You can wind up in a lot of trouble quickly.
Yeah, real bad. On August 9th, 1971, the government of Northern Ireland, led by Prime Minister Brian Faulkner, began an ultimately unsuccessful policy of preventative detention of suspected terrorists, implementing the Special Powers Act. In a two-day operation, British security forces arrested 337 Northern Irish nationalists on suspicion of affiliation with the Irish Republican Army terrorist organization and detained them without trial. After 5 weeks, Faulkner signed internment orders for 219 of those suspects, directing that they would be held indefinitely in prison. The policy would continue until December 5th, 1975, during which 1,981 people would be arrested and detained in prison without trial. More than 94% of them were Roman Catholic.
Whoa. That could backfire.
On
the 12th of August, American actress and comedian Yvette Nicole Brown, best known for playing Phyllis Jenkins in Avengers Endgame, was born in East Cleveland, Ohio.
I never get tired of that bit.
It's a good bit. And then on the 13th, Marvel Comics wasn't the only thing celebrating its 10th anniversary this month. On the 10th anniversary of the erection of the Berlin Wall, the city of West Berlin dedicated the Weißeskreuze, which is the White Crosses Garden, as a memorial for the 102 fatalities at the Berlin Wall up to that point. By the time the wall was opened in 1989, the number of crosses had increased to 140. In East Berlin, the anniversary was marked by parades honoring 10 years of the Antifaschischer Schutzwall, the anti-fascist protective wall, as they called it, with a banner bearing the slogan, 10 years of secure protection of peace and socialism, which I'm sure really bugged Martin Goodman, because I think he wanted to use 10 years of secure protection of peace and socialism for Marvel's 10th birthday. But they snagged it.
Speaking of some bizarre fascism, on August 14th, at Stanford University, psychology professor Philip Zimbardo's infamous Stanford Prison Experiment began. The experiment was designed to examine the effects of situational variables on participants' reactions and behaviors in a two-week simulation of a prison environment. Participants were recruited from the local community with an ad in the newspaper offering $15 per day to male students who wanted to participate in a psychological study of prison life. Volunteers were chosen after assessments of psychological stability and then randomly assigned to being prisoners or guards. The experiment officially started when prisoners were arrested by real Palo Alto police. Over the following 5 days, psychological abuse of the prisoners by the guards became increasingly brutal. After Professor Christina Maslach visited to evaluate the conditions, she was so upset to see how study participants were behaving that she confronted Zimbardo. He ended the experiment on the sixth day, 8 days before the scheduled completion. Ooh. Have any of you seen that movie?
Yeah.
That movie is so crazy. Yeah. Yeah, like you're watching it and it's ramping up and the behavior's getting crazy and you're like, oh my God, I can't believe this is real. This is so intense.
Yeah.
And then it like fades to black and then you get a title card and it says like day two.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. I was like, what? I stood up. I stood up from the couch and was like, whoa, I need a breather. That was crazy. Yeah. That's just like crazy human nature stuff.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, on the 18th of August, Australia and New Zealand announced the withdrawal of their troops from South Vietnam and an end to their participation in the Vietnam War, with the first Australian task force to depart in October. Right. Australia still had 6,000 combat troops in South Vietnam, down from a high of 8,000, while New Zealand still had 264 remaining in war zones.
And you know that that's the sign that Vietnam is really not going well, because, I mean, everyone knows, if you've ever played Risk, once you lose Australia, like, that's, you know.
Yeah, it's over. It's I mean, over. You really, yeah.
Yeah.
Time to pack it up.
And it's staying in that part of the world. On the 21st of August, for the first time since the end of the Korean War in 1953, representatives of North Korea and South Korea met to discuss agreements between the two nations. The meeting of Red Cross officials from both countries took place at Panmunjom and lasted for only 4 minutes, but marked what could be the start on a long road toward a thaw in the relations between the two parts of Korea, in the opinion of one very, very optimistic observer.
Yeah. Pretty rose-colored.
Yeah.
On August 22nd, English actor Richard Armitage, best known for playing Heinz Kruger in Captain America: The First Avenger, was born in Leicester.
On the 24th, the decision by Canada to dismantle its nuclear-tipped Bomarc anti-aircraft missiles was announced by Donald MacDonald, Canada's Minister of National Defense.
Is there a more Canadian name than Donald MacDonald?
Yeah. It was so hard to do a straight face. Since 1962, the missiles had been maintained at the Canadian Forces bases in North Bay, Ontario, and Lamakaza, Quebec.
And then wrapping up, on the 30th of August, legislative elections for South Vietnam were conducted with 1,240 candidates competing to fill the 159 seats of the Republic of Vietnam House of Representatives. And those would be the last legislative elections that the Republic of Vietnam would ever hold. So that's a little bit of a spoiler alert for what's coming in the not too distant future in Vietnam. So that's a glimpse of what was going on in the world in August of 1971. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about what was happening in the Marvel Comics of August of 1971 right here on Marvel by the Month. All right, it is time for a little sponsor break. As regular listeners know, this season, each episode of Marvel by the Month is sponsored by one of the advertisers from the comics that we're talking about. This is the sort of thing that can happen when you make the mistake of retaining Kang as your business manager. Rob, so far we have advertised live animals delivered through the mail, dubious health and fitness programs, and Ponzi schemes for children. I'd like to go with something a little bit more, I don't know, like morally defensible, I guess. Hmm. What have you got for us?
How about Patches?
Well, is Patches the name of a puppy that they cram into a box and ship to your house?
Nope.
Is Patches the name of a clown that they cram into a box and ship to your house?
No, they're just regular old Patches. Be a standout in your crowd. Patches are in. Design your own look. put these colorful patches on hats, shirts, hot pants, mesh boots, bags, jeans, everywhere. Machine washable and guaranteed not to run.
Guaranteed not to run. Oh, I get it, because one of them is an American flag design. Look at that. And then there's a Stars and Stripes peace sign and a regular peace sign and a little badge-shaped patch that says Peace Chief on it. Cute. And then next to that is there's a Red Baron biplane with an Iron Cross on the tail. And then there's just an Iron Cross and, now I'm seeing a Confederate flag there.
Okay, I think we're done for this week.
Rush your order today?
No, do not rush your order today, please. Fortunately, we are also supported each and every week by our subscribers at patreon.com/MarvelByTheMonth who help us make this show week after week. Thanks to them, we are not dependent on dubious patch vendors.
Everyone who supports Marvel by the Month at the $4 a month level gets access to our bonus feed of almost 50 extended and exclusive episodes. Some of them are twice as long as the version that winds up in the public feed.
And most of those extended episodes feature deeper dives on more comics with some of our favorite guests, including Mike Allred, Matt Fraction, Chelsea Kane, Tom Brevoort, Mark Evanier, Douglas Wolk, Joe Keating, and Tom Brevoort. I mentioned Tom twice because as of this week, there are two extended episodes with him as the guest.
And hey, not only do you get some great extra content that you can't hear anywhere else, you also get the warm feeling in your tummy that comes from helping us create this show. You'll be a patron of the arts, like a Medici or something. Head to patreon.com/MarvelByTheMonth now for instant access to all of our past, present, and future subscriber-exclusive content. Okay, welcome back to Marvel by the Month. I am going to tell you about The Alien, The Ally, and Armageddon. It's Fantastic Four number 116, written by my man, Archie Goodwin, art by John Buscema and Joe Sinnott. So just to catch us up on how we have gotten to where we're at in this story, for what seems like the last 15 months, the Fantastic Four have been facing off against a new cosmic level adversary known as the Overmind. Now, the Overmind is the collective embodiment of a star-faring warlike race known as the Eternals, but not those Eternals. He's basically invulnerable. He's all powerful. He has the ability to dominate the minds of anyone he encounters. Last issue, we saw that even Reed Richards, the smartest man in the world, couldn't resist the Overmind's control. So we begin this issue with the Fantastic Three picking up the pieces after Reed has escaped with the Overmind. And so by working together, Sue, Ben, and Johnny managed to figure out a way to track the specific radiation that Reed was exposed to, which gives them a way to track him. But on their way out the door, they're harassed by their landlord and some cops who Reed roughed up a bit in the last issue. And this is before he was, you know, not in his right mind. So
that was just right. Normal Reed. Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty great Reed moment. Johnny doesn't think twice about nearly frying them to clear a path. Ben suspends the landlord from a mangled street sign, which I think if anyone who has ever dealt with, you know, landlords in Manhattan, probably this is, you know, feels pretty good. we cut to Reed, who's desperately trying to resist the Overmind's mental control, and suddenly the Thing and the Torch appear on the scene to take the fight to the Overmind as Sue is trying to rescue Reed. But the Overmind is just too powerful. He overpowers Ben and Johnny. He reasserts his control over Reed, who nearly catches Sue before she can escape, and so now Sue is the last of the four left standing, which is like the drama has heightened significantly. You know, all the heavy hitters left, and you know, Sue, who we've sort of been conditioned to think as the, you know, the weak link in the Fantastic Four. She's the only one left.
The girl.
Yeah, she's the girl, right? Yeah,
right.
What can she do?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you. She's the girl.
She can pull out her Rolodex.
She heads to Avengers Mansion, where Jarvis is cowering in the shadows and nearly shoots her. and Rob is going to tell us why the Avengers are unavailable in just a few minutes. But, you know, as Tom said, she basically pulls out her mental Rolodex. She goes down the list of every hero she could think to call for help. But wouldn't you know it, they're all busy with their own adventures because, you know, it's a double page count month. So everyone's busy. And that's when Agatha Harkness appears to Sue in a vision and says that if the heroes are unavailable, there's only one alternative, and that's Dr. Doom. So Sue gets a lot to do in this issue, and I like it.
Yeah, me too.
It is a lot of like support action and a lot of, you know, standing and pointing. She actually does have an active role in advancing the plot at several points here. And is like, you know, puts herself in harm's way. And it's, I don't know. It was refreshing to see.
Yeah, and she's piloting that go-kart thing, like that space go-kart thing, like a champion. Like every couple pages they bring it back and she's zooming around at crazy angles and that they like kept it going the whole time. I thought that was cool.
Like a some kind of Peloton device that flies. Yeah.
Yep, it's a cosmic Peloton. So Sue heads to the Latverian embassy. She probably violates all sorts of international laws by breaking in and demanding an audience with Doom. Also a very cool move to see Sue pulling. Mm-hmm. And that gives Doom enough time to be seated in a very cool chair and leisurely blowing some smoke rings when she shows up.
I never took him for a smoker, but there it is.
Yeah. I think he just took it up so he could do that. So at first Doom refuses her. As far as he's concerned, Overmind's doing his work for him by taking out the FF. So Sue turns on the romance comic tears and she says that, well, Doom might be ruthless and cold. She always thought he had honor and nobility too. But the Doom she sees before her is nothing but posturing and pettiness and maybe a little bit afraid.
Sue's go-to move.
Yep.
I never thought you'd be a coward, Ben Grimm.
Yeah, right.
Sue's go-to move is negging. I will get you to do this thing by making you feel bad.
Yeah. And it's pretty totally solid works.
Mom move. It totally works.
Doom replies, many demons rule Victor Von Doom, but not those of pettiness or fear, which
disagree a lot, but
I would say pettiness is most of what motivates Dr. Doom,
like the pie chart of his of his motivation.
So I was trying to think back and like I feel like this is the first time we have seen Doom on the side of the angels, like fully, you know, with the good guys. In annual number two, you know, we get his backstory, which makes him more sympathetic. And then we've just seen the Jerry Conway story where we find out that his mom is in hell and he tries to rescue her every midsummer.
Right.
They
tried a few times to transition Doom, who was clearly very popular, into a lead. There was that Marvel superhero story where he fights Diablo and we meet Valeria, his old girlfriend, for the first time and so forth. But this is the first time where he actually ever really legitimately teams up with anybody, and particularly with the Fantastic Four, who are really his arch nemesis.
And I feel like they've especially like since annual number two, they've been very clever about doing things like this and not taking it too far either. Like they just give you a little bit more of, you know, the complexity behind the character. Like really, like Dr. Doom could so easily be this one dimensional cartoonish supervillain. I mean, he's a guy in a suit of armor who calls himself Dr. Doom.
Yeah. You if know, you look like, at him, he is, but yeah,
he is, right.
Yeah. But he does have this like tragic aspect.
His name was Victor Von Doom. He kind of had no choice the moment he came into this world. Like that guy's not going to be a pediatrician.
Right. That would have been,
he's not going to be a parking attendant. You know, he's not going to be a mailman. The guy's name is Victor Von Doom. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy from that.
Yeah. Stephen Strange had to be so much better at surgery than anybody else just so that he could get a patient to let him, you know, do surgery.
Right. Stephen Strange really should have gone the same route, but he had that one talent and he was able to parlay it and find, he became kind of a jerk of a surgeon, Yeah. But, you know, so you can see he wasn't a good guy, but he at least, you know, pulled in a paycheck. And,
yeah.
Yep. Right.
You know, until he went driving that one night. You know, like he stayed on the right side.
But he also actually got a doctorate, so that helped. You know,
which I still have we ever found out where Doom actually got his doctorate from? Like, is this stolen valor?
I don't know. I thought it was University of Phoenix kind of situation. Where okay.
I think it's Doom University or Latveria U.
Right. He's got his own.
He clearly got expelled from Empire State. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know where he gets off calling himself doctor, but it's another conversation for another day. So they head to Sue and Doom head to Reed's laboratory because, you know, Doom's like, you know, we're going to need more than just strength and numbers, because if that's all it was going to take to beat this guy, you jokers would have done that by now. Okay. So meanwhile, the Overmind has crushed Johnny and Ben. He's about to start on the rest of humanity. And Johnny awakens to Doom, ordering him to rise. And he and Ben are about to throw down with Doom before Sue explains everything and says, look, this is what we got to work with. So let's just make the best of it. And so they take the fight to the Overmind. Doom is using a psionic refractor. This is just a funny little bit that Archie, you know, shoehorns in there. Like, Doom claims to have built the thing, but everyone knows that he just finished the thing that Reed started building.
Reed had lying around.
Yes. it's just such a subtle little detail. I love that.
Yeah, it was a nice touch.
Yeah. And Ben and Johnny are supposed to keep him busy while Doom keeps turning the Overmind's psionic power against him. But, I mean, come on, he's called the Overmind. He's going to figure this out pretty quickly. Sue tries to protect Doom with her force field. She has to use it on herself as a mentally dominated Reed tries to strangle her, which is pretty uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was...
Yeah.
Rubbery fingers.
Just like wrapping around and around her little egg shell that's like you assume is getting smaller and smaller. And his face, Reed's deranged face always looks great.
Oh, yeah.
Anytime he looks crazy, it's so disturbing. It's so awesome. I don't know if it's the temples. Something I think to do with the white temples.
Yeah, I think it's Angry Dad. Like, I think Angry Dad is just terrifying.
Right. Yeah, that says more about me, I guess, than anything else. That's where I'm coming from.
Yeah. Well, so finally, on page 28, the Overmind blasts Doom to smithereens and stands victorious. So nothing has worked. But wait. A fireball streaks from the sky and lands in front of the Overmind. It's the Stranger, that ill-defined cosmic character who so far just kind of randomly kidnaps villains and takes them to his home world for unspecified reasons. And so you remember back at the beginning of the story where we learned that the Overmind is the sum of all the Eternals, and again, not those Eternals, but the Eternals. Well, it turns out that the Stranger is the sum of all the inhabitants of Gigantus, which is the very large world that was the only one to ever defeat the Eternals, which is a very convenient twist.
And he has billions and billions of minds. So, yes. That's
as opposed
bigger.
To Overmind only has billions of minds.
Yeah.
So it's like a whole
so
geometric.
I did the math and
Anyway, so the Stranger evaporates the Overmind in about three panels and sends him to a subatomic world, and then he zips back off into space.
Looks awesome. The end of this issue looks so cool.
It looks awesome, but also, Johnny, he comes to, and he kind of says what I think all the readers were thinking. He's annoyed that they spent all that time fighting the Overmind when the Stranger could have shown up anytime and just taken care of him anytime he wanted. But then the Watcher shows up. He's like, no, actually, you guys were a very important part of this entire plan. You are what drew the Stranger's attention to him. Otherwise, he would have had to conquer many worlds before the Stranger finally figured out what was going on. So you see, it was totally worth it after all.
This is in the pharmaceutical advertising industry, this is what you call an objection handler, where you voice the complaint in advance and you have a ready-made answer to provide
it. Nice. Yeah.
It's weird that you know that, but yeah.
It's so weird that I know that.
So yeah, I don't love this ending. I also suspect, though, that when this story began, I don't think Stan and Company had an ending in mind either. So,
I disagree with that. Uh-huh. In that, at least at the point, and it was the issue before this, it was 115, okay, where we learn the origin of the Overmind. Mm-hmm. And at that point where they lay out, you know, the Eternals had been this race and they did all this stuff and they were warlike and eventually they found the planet of Gigantus and it was just so big that they couldn't take it and were defeated and,
right,
and undone, and they put all their guys together to make the Overmind. That's clearly set up for, and learning that they did that, all the Gigantus guys put all their guys together into a bigger guy. And that'll be the Stranger. You know, the real fault here is that the Stranger isn't foreshadowed anywhere in this story. He shows up on page whatever it is, I'll say 32,
right,
you know, out of nowhere. He just shows up, and it's good that his name is the Stranger, because that literally just, you know, describes him in this tale as the ultimate sort of deus ex machina. I'm here to take care of the problem.
Yeah,
right.
I'm like the Silver Surfer in Thor, except I get shit done.
Yeah.
And that's it. And I'm out, you know.
Yeah.
You know, that having been said, it was, that setup is clearly there in 115.
Yeah. And I think that was the first issue that Archie Goodwin wrote. Cause I think he did 115 and 116, and
Archie scripted 115, but he did not, he didn't do plot the plot.
Okay. No. There you go.
Interesting.
No, 115 was, it was plotted verbally, I'm sure, by Stan. He and John were working and they talked it through. Archie dialogued 115.
Okay.
But he plotted 160. So well, this is the first issue of Fantastic Four in the run that has had no story involvement from Stan.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
So for the 10th anniversary, we've gotten rid of everybody.
Wow. What could go wrong?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Actually, you know what? Looking at it from that angle, like the ending does make more sense, but I think you're right. Like, it is the fact that the Stranger's never teased, and if you hadn't been reading Marvel comics all along, like, you'd have no idea who this guy was, or, you know, like, he's never even alluded to. Yeah,
yeah. I don't disagree with you, but this sort of storytelling, the there's a character from an old story that comes back and is terribly important, has kind of been a part of the Marvel formula at this point for years.
True.
Roy Thomas in particular really liked to do this kind of thing. Hey, here's this guy from an old comic that I read. And so this reveal on the Stranger about, like you said, whom we know nothing at this point, other than he's from outer space and he likes grabbing mutants to look at, right, keep in jars. You know, so at least there's a feeling, if you're a longtime reader, and by longtime I mean more than 3 months, look, we're learning something new about an established Marvel character, as opposed to like the Overmind, who literally is only 3 months old.
Yeah,
right.
New character. So I agree. It would have been better structured if somewhere earlier somebody set up the idea that the Stranger is even a thing.
Yeah.
Because he just shows up on, you know, the Overmind goes, I've beaten everybody, and then a dude shows up, and he's not anywhere in the 300 pages that came before this.
Right.
But you know, in the you know, the idea that all the Marvel comics form the Marvel universe and it's all interconnected and there's stuff from everywhere that could be important, this kind of fits that pattern.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so this is actually something I'm curious about. So, I mean, one of the great strengths of the Marvel universe is that you have literally thousands of characters that all have, to greater or lesser degrees, intertwined stories. And you can do things like this where you can, you know, you could pull in a character as a big surprise. And the more Marvel comics you have read, the greater the chances it's going to really pop for you. And you're going to get this. It creates sort of an effect that you can't get from a lot of other things. So how do you, like, when you're looking to, you know, help a team plot through some sort of surprise like that, like, what do you look for and what do you look to avoid?
Well, again, and I don't want to cast any aspersions. These guys were all doing big double-sized issues in a month.
Right.
Where they had to do a lot of them on the fly. Mm-hmm. But I definitely would have been going, we need to set the Stranger up before this. Sure. And we need to set him up in this comic, not even last month. Although last month would have been better than nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you need to put the gun on the mantelpiece before you use it. Somebody somewhere needs to talk about the Stranger, even just in passing.
Yeah. So the Overmind is they discover the Overmind's coming, and then like Reed brings up a board of all the cosmic figures that they've met so far.
Exactly. You know, he's more powerful than the Watcher and Galactus and the Stranger and the this.
Right.
So at least you have some context for who that guy is when he shows up.
Yeah.
You know, and then you want it to be a mystery that makes sense. And more or less this kind of does. Like I remember as a reader reading this, and I read it after it was published. So I went back and read it. I was satisfied with this as a reveal of here's the Stranger's real origin. Apparently other people weren't, because this all got thrown out shortly thereafter.
No way, really?
Yeah. And in later years, it was the Stranger came across the dead body of the guy who was the gigantist and decided, I'll do his chores. What the heck? Because somebody couldn't fathom why. A guy who had that origin and background was doing all of his I'm going to experiment on people and occasionally decide to destroy the Earth stuff.
But as
a moment here, as a reader myself, I thought it was fine. I thought it was very much in keeping with that sort of, hey, look, I learned something new about this character who was just a mystery before this point. So it really just kind of comes down to that. But you have to plant all of your story material in the story, or else it really does feel like it's deus ex machina. It's out of left field.
Right.
And in this particular issue, the Stranger is absolutely that.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I think it was maybe also just a little dissatisfying, because I kind of wanted Doom to somehow win, because then the complexity of Doom saving the Fantastic Four then becomes a story element for a while.
Yeah, you would have what happens with Valeria, like with the second daughter, much earlier on, and that would have like pivoted the whole situation like way earlier.
Right.
Yeah,
but that was probably more of a pivot than anybody wanted to do here. Stan was out, but he was coming back. You know, he expected all the furniture to still be where he left it when he returned. So, you know, don't turn things inside out or anything. Just keep it all going.
Can you imagine? You did what? What did you do? I left. Right. I was gone for 3 months.
And I got to say, as a reader, I thought this was a great issue. I liked it top to bottom. I thought it looked great. I thought it read well. I thought everybody came across well. It's definitely, you know, like we look back on Doom now because there have been 10 million other appearances since it. And he's a much more complex character as a result. But at the period, this is by far the most complex and nuanced rendition of Doom. Even at the end where everybody's kind of getting up, Doom doesn't, you know, I don't want any thanks. You know, spare me your shit. Next time we meet, I'm going to take your heads off. See you later. Like, there's definitely something that adds to the mystique of that character in this.
Yeah.
He's almost becomes a tragic figure again, more than just a villainous figure. And that informs every other time he comes, you know, he shows up after this. So I feel like Archie in particular had like a nice nuanced handle on him. Yep. And you know, brought some additional angles to the character, to the Four, to make him a little bit more interesting and a little bit more three-dimensional than the average, you know, mustache twirling, metal mask wearing bad guy.
Yeah.
No, Archie, this is my favorite Fantastic Four issue since, you know, like early mid Kirby Stan Lee run with Sinnott inking and getting to have him ink here too. Yep. It just, it looks great. It feels like a Fantastic Four issue, you know?
Yes, very much so.
Where it's felt a little rudderless for a bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, speaking of, before you stop here, speaking of it, this story, and technically, I think even the next two kind of continue from this because the torch heads off to deal with Crystal stuff. Going back to like 105, if you look at that stretch and read it all in a row, there are no breaks. It all takes place over the course of the same day or two.
No way, really?
So it's the most packed day there is. You know, it starts with the thing and the torch and Crystal getting a hot dog. Crystal gets sick. They got to get her out of here. Oh, Reed's got a new cure for the thing. Oh, we got this guy. I know he's turned into a monster. Got to freeze the thing. Get the thing out. Oh, the thing can turn back to normal. Oh wait, Janice has shown up. He wants to go to the negative zone. That's a bad idea. Oh, he could win it anyway. Oh, now Janice is doing stuff. We got to go into the negative zone. Oh, Reed is trapped. We got to send them the gyroscope to get out. Oh, the thing's gone bananas because his cure isn't working right. He's going on the rampage. He's breaking everything. The Hulk shows up and fights him and kills him, but he's not really dead. Reed's able to bring him back to the lab and electrode him. And then the Overmind shows up and the Watcher says, watch out for this Overmind dude. And the city turns against the FF and Reed goes crazy and they got to call Doom. And then they have dinner.
Right.
You know, and that's...
It's like a season of 24. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And really, you know, like none of it was necessarily intended that way, but nobody... Yeah. Really bothered to plot in a pause,
a break in the action.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, they all serially go one to the next.
Oof. Yeah,
I love it. That's so great.
I love that recounting too, because that is the like breathless way that it feels like you're just falling down a hill in this story. Like it, things won't stop happening. I'm in the tunnel and Willy Wonka's driving a boat. Yeah.
Well, the FF haven't had a break, but I think we can take one after all of that. So we'll take a quick break. We'll be back with more of the Marvel Comics of August 1971 right here on Marvel by the Month.
Welcome back to Marvel by the Month. Let's talk about Avengers number 93, This Beachhead Earth. It's written by Roy Thomas, art by Neil Adams and Tom Palmer. This issue begins with Vision bursting into Avengers Mansion and passing out or dying, since the Avengers there can't tell if he's alive. The roll call on the scene is the old guard, who we saw recently fire the new guard. So this is Cap, Thor, and Iron Man.
And I think Tom alluded to this earlier in the show, but the Vision collapses saying, help me, please help me.
Mm-hmm.
Tom, do you want to do the honors and say what he was supposed to say?
Well, when Neil Adams was drawing the issue, you know, he would write border notes in the margins and such for Roy, like most of the guys at this time would do. And his dialogue for the Vision was, three cows shot me down. And Neil wanted that to be the title of the story.
Yeah.
Three cows shot me down. And Roy didn't like it and didn't use it. And Neil apparently was pissed about that for years. Eventually in the '90s, late '90s, we did a trade paperback collection, the first trade paperback collection of the Kree-Skrull War in one volume, and Neil did a new cover, but he would only agree to do it if he could, you know, he could have that scene of the Vision like phasing through the door saying, three cows shot me down.
Oh, that's awesome.
So that's where that trade paperback cover comes from.
Yep.
Wow. So he held on this, like this meant something to him for well over two decades.
He really, he really liked that line or that idea. And he thought it was suitably like intriguing and trippy and whatever.
Yeah.
And he didn't, he didn't agree with Roy's choice to go a different way.
And yeah,
I agree with Neil here too. Yeah.
I was going to say,
that's like
God bless Neil Adams. He could be like a dog with a bone. if he got the idea in his head, like you're not going to get that away from him. I think the reason that Roy didn't go with that as the title of the story is like all the titles in the Kree-Skrull War issues are slight variations on like famous science fiction stories or science fiction movies. So,
but really, the reason Roy didn't go with it as much as anything, you know, certainly there is that he established the pattern already.
Yeah.
But he knew that if he used that title, Stan wouldn't like it and Stan would give him grief. Yeah. And so Roy said, I can't do this. Stan will not, you know, if I don't change it, Stan will change it. Oh. And Stan will, you know, give me an earful about how, you know, not only is having a wordless sequence going to cause us to have letters, but how a stupid title like that isn't going to work and isn't appropriate for Marvel Comics.
People would have talked about it forever. I mean, that's like episode one of Lost.
We're still talking about it.
It is 2022, 50 years later, and we are still talking about it. So Neil did kind of win out on that one.
Yeah, I guess I do
want a T-shirt of that. Yeah. So anyway, the old guard is here. Vision just burst in and didn't get to say those lines. And then they hear a voice from an unseen person and they assume it has something to do with Vision, you know, possibly perishing. But it turns out to be Hank Pym as Ant-Man, for some reason, staying at ant size, before everybody gets too worried.
It's more fun to draw.
Yeah, that's true. It's great. This is all a joy to look at.
Before you
get too worried about Ant-Man's return, he announces to Cap that he came in answer to a summons, but he is an ex-Avenger, not just on a leave of absence. So he's just confirmed he quit. So we all can be, it's fine. We're not going to have a Hank Pym here.
For the next 7 issues.
Yeah.
He's definitely done.
Yeah, right. Totally out this time. Hank Pym
quits the Avengers like I quit buying comics. Seriously, I'm running out of room. I cannot buy anymore.
Well, that's the reason he changes his costume and identity so often, is so he can show up at Avengers Mansion. Oh, I'm not Ant-Man. I'm a new guy. I'm Giant Man. I'm going to be an Avenger.
They're like, all right, Hank, we're not paying you more.
Well, it's great. They get to haze him like 5 times.
So Hank and the old, you know, Avengers team, they recount their relationship to Vision that Hank has, which is basically Grandpa. Hank made Ultron 1. Ultron 1 made 5 more versions of Ultron himself. And then as Ultron 6, he created Vision. So to find out what's wrong with Vish, Hank has the bright idea to crawl into his mouth with some ants. And that could also be a great title that Stan would have hated. Hank's journey into Vision is nothing but Neil Adams' cool stuff.
It's stunning.
Hank almost immediately loses one of his ants to Vision's version of an immune system. That ant was called Crosby. The other two are Stills and Nash. And I was amused. Hank tells the other two ants to leave, you know, so they don't get killed, because he doesn't want to hear the scream of ants dying. And then
he goes on about that for a little while. Like
he does.
He's got some ant death trauma.
He's got PTSD. Yeah.
You put that helmet on,
you communicate with ants, you know, so when they die.
What was going on when he would just like fire himself like a rocket into piles of them? Like, did he not care what they said?
They were soft. They were soft ants.
I don't think so.
He was tiny. He didn't weigh much. He also talks in here about having been an EC Comics fan. In a very weird, very Roy Thomas reference.
Yeah,
that can't imagine that half the readership even understood.
Oh, and then he drops like Al Feldstein's name at some point. Which again, like the half that did get the EC Comics reference, 90% of them did not get that reference. So
But none of that matters because it looks so good. You know, if you're a kid, you're just glossing over that. It's like Bugs Bunny jokes that are for the adults. So there's a bunch of Hank. So he, after the ants leave, he jetpacks through Vision's body. And there's a bunch of, a lot of Hank interacting with weird things in Vision's body. A bubble makes one hand intangible for a bit. Hank gets into more bubbles so that he can get himself into a tube and get away from some other antibodies, and then also access Vision's brain.
Antibodies.
Nice. Thank you. He finds a loose wire.
The antibodies were named Peter, Paul, and Mary.
And scene. Well done.
So all of this is, it's taking quite a while of this book. He finds a loose wire, reconnects it in Vision's brain, then gets back and out in time for Vision to wake up. And we are now on page 17.
But before he does, he sees something very interesting in the Vision's body that we don't find out about for another.
Yes.
Right.
Do they go back to that?
That becomes a big part of the Vision history over the next couple of years. What Ant-Man sees is some nebulous evidence that the Vision used to be the original Human Torch.
Whoa, cool.
Roy doesn't really get to go back to that, but Steve Englehart, who succeeds him, spends about 2 years building up that subplot and eventually revealing all that stuff in the origin of the Vision.
Was that the plan from this panel? Like, was that the intention?
That was Neil's idea.
Cool.
Like, Neil just drew it in here and wrote a note to Roy saying he sees something that says, so that was apparently, for all that seems like such a Roy Thomas idea, that apparently was actually a Neil idea. And Roy liked it enough to go with it, and liked it enough to not only mention it to Steve Englehart, but maybe even to Needle Engel. When are you going to do that thing with the Human Torch, Steve? enough that Steve actually, carried forward on it and paid off on it.
Wow. Cool. That's awesome. Again, it's that little nugget that gets picked up on later and becomes a whole story. And Vision wakes up, now that his wires reconnected, and reminds the Avengers how they so callously dismissed four other Avengers last issue, which Cap, Thor, and Iron Man do not remember. And they didn't actually expel those members. So Iron Man got wind of something weird because Jarvis tendered his resignation and said, since no one's here, and you fired everyone, I guess I'll leave. So the four members that were disbanded were Quicksilver, Scarlet Witch, Goliath, and Vision. And once they did get fired, we start to find out from Vision what happened. They went to a farm upstate where Carol Danvers took Captain Marvel to hide from the alien witch hunt that had started by a senator or congressperson named Craddock. I can't remember.
H. Warren Craddock.
Yeah. So while deciding how to climb over a fence, Vision and Wanda almost have a moment that Pietro breaks up. Then Vision flies over the fence and flies over a few cows, but is suddenly struck down.
And how many cows?
A few, three to be exact.
And less than four.
Have you guessed what has happened, dear listeners? Maybe you know what's coming, but this is one of those moments that we were talking about earlier where Roy Thomas pays off on a plot point from a decade before.
Amazing. Oh,
it's so cool.
Yeah. The cows change shape and become the male three quarters of the Fantastic Four. So Pietro and Wanda are quickly subdued and captured by the FF, and Vision goes into some autopilot mode after getting shot down, and his unconscious and intangible body goes floating first into the ground for a while they fight, and then floats up, and then just sort of floats all the way to Avengers Mansion in New York. So
it's a great feature. That was like thinking way ahead.
But he did, of course, it gets a little weird because he's floating sort of like some magic trick where he's just laying on his back, and they show him float all the way there. But we know at the beginning that he burst in and talking conscious.
Oh, yeah.
So this is a little thing. So this is all just a setup for part three, where we see Captain Marvel and Carol Danvers being held by none other than the Three Skrulls. This is suddenly shaping up to have both a Kree and Skrulls might even get a war at some point. Yeah.
Hey, whoa.
So the Skrulls are monitoring the ever giant Clint Barton as he giantly sneaks around the farm. Clint runs into Rick Jones first, but they are both just quickly captured by the FF boys. Rick is being held by Reed when he says, "Okay, so you got me, big deal, but who in blazes are you? You could be Reed Richards, but that sure ain't the Torch and the Thing. They never talked that good in their lives." And I just love that whole little line. It's just beautiful. So the three, understand that they, you know, the jig is up. They revert to their normal Skrull look as the Reed Skrull recounts events from, you guessed it, Fantastic Four issue number 2, when Reed hypnotized the Three Skrulls on Earth into thinking they were cows.
Wow.
So that was where he left them. But a Skrull hyperbeam from space revived them at some point. So these are the three cows. And apparently they decided when Vision was flying in to go back to their cow state, just to surprise them. You know, I like that they just kind of revert to cows every once in a while. well, they
spent 10 years as cows. It's probably feeling pretty comfortable now.
Now the Avengers arrive on the farm. The Skrulls head out to fight them, and Captain Marvel breaks himself and Carol free. Then he immediately starts working on an Omniwave projector using the Skrull technology so he can contact the Kree. He points out to Carol that it can also become the most dangerous weapon in the cosmos.
right. Yeah. It's a cell phone and it's an Uzi.
Yeah. And as he finishes, though, he immediately destroys the device because Carol referred to him as Mar-Vell, which is not a name she knows the captain by. So it turns out Carol is also a Skrull, but not just any Skrull. She's the Super Skrull. Or they are the Super Skrull. I think we should be gender neutral here at this point.
Right.
Good call.
Which is a weird plot turn in a story in which you have three other Skrulls running around pretending to be the Fantastic Four. Surely the Super Skrull should have been one of those guys.
Yeah,
maybe
right.
Two or three of those guys. But, you know.
Shortest straw, you've just got to be Carol playing it safe for a while. So Super Skrull takes the ship disguised as a house, breaks the house off, the house shell off into the air, and notes that Captain Marvel, Quicksilver, and Scarlet Witch are the prizes he sought on Earth, and the other Skrulls are all expendable. So they've spent 10 years as cows.
They're
and
cows.
Yeah. So
we got plenty of cows on Skrulls.
They obviously didn't miss them for 10 years. So, you know,
yeah.
They learned how to get by without them.
But he didn't count on the one thing that might take his ship down, which is a large guy jumping onto it and punching it. Unfortunately for Clint's genius plan of jumping on the ship and punching it, just as he is having great success, he shrinks to normal size all of a sudden and falls off. Thor catches him, and Clint's very upset over his failure, which was mainly that he forgot to take his regular dose of Hank's growth serum, which he mustn't have forgotten for like every meeting where he sits in his giant chair, every time he's just trying to not be able to get into a cab, you know, all this stuff.
Taking up five times as much space as he needs to on a plane. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Him just like banging into everything on the Quinjet. That's where we end this. We get a really disappointed Clint in himself. Captain America tries to give everybody a pep talk. Rick Jones starts to worry that maybe the Avengers aren't up for this massive task, and we just get left there. It was a really fun issue. I was happy to have an extra long issue that was this one.
Yeah.
It certainly helps that that Neil Adams drew it.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Totally. It's like, did you need 15 pages of him walking through Vision's body for no particular reason? Probably not, but I loved every second of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think of all the issues that we read this month, you know, the extra long issues, I think this is the one that does the most cool stuff with it. I think Fantastic Four is a close second. I think there's a lot of really fun stuff in that as well. But yeah, they just like made the best of the real estate here. I think I remember reading something about this actually, it kind of got them a little messed up on deadlines. Like Neil was struggling to be able to hit the deadline for this issue because it was, you know, 50% longer than it was originally scheduled to be. And I don't know, maybe that has something to do with the fact that he doesn't wind up drawing the very last issue of the Kree Skrull War. I'm not
sure. He doesn't, I think even the next issue, spoiler for next time.
Yeah. Oh, boo.
The next issue is broken up into chapters and Yasemite is one of the chapters.
That's right. Yep.
Like Neil's already in schedule trouble at this point.
Yeah.
He's already behind. Neil, partly because he was doing so much, you know, at the same time he's doing this, he's still doing work for DC.
Yeah.
And he still started to do, you know, the commercial work he was doing on the side and so forth. And he was never the most deadline reliable. Like much like Steranko, he would go down to the 11th hour often, sometimes deliberately. You know, certainly Steranko would do it deliberately on occasion, but Neil would sometimes intentionally and sometimes not, so that, you know, people didn't have a lot of time to mess around with what he had done. You know, he caused a lot of gray hairs in the bullpen of this period, and certainly him having to do issues that are 34 pages long,
yeah,
as opposed to 20, didn't make it any easier.
No.
Well, you can tell in this one because the first half is like he's going through Vision and there's everything is a crazy sci-fi background, and then the last couple of pages the backgrounds are just like green.
Like
behind the spaceship it's just green, and then it's just pink, and then it's just blue, and then it's just red. Like there's no backgrounds.
It is a thing psychologically, and I know this from you know, working with different artists and things over the years. Like if you're used to doing comics that are 20 pages long, you do 20 pages, you're done, you're on to the next one. Even if you have the same amount of time to do a 40 page issue or a 30 page issue in that, psychologically, once you start to hit page 22, 23, 24, you're like, mentally, you're like, I should be done, but yeah, I have like 7 pages to go. And it's just much tougher to get through a 30 page issue than it would be to get through a 20 and a 10.
Wow. I felt that way reading them, just because we're so accustomed to the
rhythm page count. Yeah.
Well, speaking of the rhythm, like I don't think this issue is as well put together as the FF one. I think the FF one is better structured because that issue is about the thing it's about. This issue is super fun and super great and does a lot of cool things, but a lot of it is just, it's Neil having fun. You know, the plot is kind of sloshy and messy. Like it really does feel like two separate issues that have been put together. The first half is we're going to do the fantastic voyage into the Vision. And then the second half has almost nothing to do with the first half, which is we're going to fight some cows on a farm that are really Skrulls.
Right.
You know, and like Thor, Cap and Iron Man are really only going to show up on like the last page. And you really do kind of feel like maybe not Cap, but you know, Thor and Iron Man maybe could have done something about that getaway building and not left it to Goliath, you know.
Right.
Thor could have thrown his hammer at it. It's not like he hasn't done that a million times before.
Yeah, right.
But, Thor could have whirled his hammer and made a vortex and brought the thing back in time.
Exactly. Yeah, but, you know, it was the end of the issue. Everybody was tired. It was 34 pages. My God, when does this ever end?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and all three of those guys had been in their own 34-page issue earlier. So, you know, I mean, this is a very tough month for our heroes.
Yes.
Iron Man's running on fumes again.
Yeah. I mean, he constantly is.
Thor could have called up the Silver Surfer to take care of him.
Yeah. He's busy fighting a guy in a sewer. Yeah.
Yeah. Man, well, that's our comics for August of 1971. The last thing we have to do is just to share our astonishing takes, our recommendations for things that we think our listeners would like to check out that are not necessarily the Marvel comics of August 1971. So I will go ahead and kick things off. So in preparation for this year's Eisner Awards, I've been trying to read as many nominees as possible. And one of the books that I recently finished was Abraham Reisman's True Believer, The Rise and Fall of Stan Lee. Since this is a segment, though, where we recommend things that we think our listeners should check out, I'm going to once again recommend Immortal Hulk by Al Ewing and Joe Bennett. Which is nominated for the Best Continuing Series category. I just finished reading the entire run. I am so delighted to say that they stuck the landing. They went all the way back to the Hulk roots in 1950s horror comics and monster comics. And they just really played up the psychological horror and the body horror origins of the character. And this is something I feel like we have talked about recently, but like on the surface, I think that the Hulk is a deceptively simple character. And you don't necessarily think of the Hulk having, if you just think about it quickly and not deeply, you're like, oh, I mean, like, what do you do with a Hulk? Like, what are the great Hulk stories? And then you start thinking about it. And it's like, I think when you get the right team in place on that character, which has happened many, many times, like, you get, like, you understand why he is like one of the linchpins of the Marvel Universe for the last six decades and counting. And Ewing and Bennett were absolutely a great team for this. But I'm so pleased. Like, Peter David's Hulk was one of the things that I just dove into. It's like my early formative comics reading years. And it's so great. Like, I loved World War Hulk. I love Planet Hulk and a lot of stuff, you know, in between there. But when Immortal Hulk came along, I'm just like, well, here we go again. This is amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The transitions between scenes, like, it kept happening that I would get to the end of an issue and only then notice it and be like, oh, they've been doing this the whole time. Yeah. And then I would go back and reread like a bunch of issues. I mean, it is so good.
Yeah. It's smart comics.
Yeah.
Smart comics with the Hulk. It just,
I know. It shouldn't be, but it is.
Right. Civilians would never understand, but it's there. Yeah.
He doesn't smash army once, or he probably smashes army.
I'm sure he's, there's definitely some army smashing there. Rob, what do you got to recommend?
I'm way out there. I just read Mort Cinder, this by Osterheld and Alberto Brescia. It's published in 2018 by Fantagraphics. It's a collection. So Brian just covered the Eternaut a few episodes ago. That collection was written by Osterheld and drawn by Lopez. And I have that queued up. It's sitting on my shelf. And I know that Brescia worked on a later version of the Eternaut and am now looking forward to that too. I dove into Mort Cinder solely based on the cover, the subjects listed as horror and sci-fi, and a vague idea that I had heard of this artist before. And I was so delighted to find the best black and white art, you know, maybe I've ever seen, but definitely in a long time, and an obvious inspiration to folks like Frank Miller and Mike Mignola. The chiaroscuro work of black and white is amazing. So that's the easy part to sell. The fact that it was an episodic installment cartoon in an Argentinian comic magazine and the stories were published from 1962 to 1964 might sound more daunting. But with this translation, the excellent story, the innovative character of Mort, and the absolutely stunning art, this collection was a joy to read. I read it and reread it immediately, and it holds up against a lot of modern comics easily. Without ruining too much of the story for anyone, Mort is a character who has lived and relived for a very long time. So events he has witnessed span the globe and ages of human history. They're told through a poignant humanistic point of view that is both tragic and relatable. And I will now be collecting everything I can get my hands on that Brescia has worked on, and increasingly understand that the rich history of comics owes big thanks to innovators that are not just from the United States. It's crazy to think of.
I don't even understand.
So check it out.
Yeah, Fantagraphics has been doing a really nice Brescia library of a bunch of his work and new translations of them and really nice printings. So yeah, you got a lot of good stuff ahead of you.
Wow.
Yes.
Cool. Well, in preparation for the upcoming show, which will feature the insanely talented Tatiana Maslany, I think is how you say her name. If anyone hasn't seen Orphan Black, it is so good. Definitely check it out. And possibly because someone on this podcast already recommended it, I'm not sure. I started checking out the 1989 sensational She-Hulk run. It's written and penciled by John Byrne, inked by Bob Wycheck. Is that how you say?
Wycheck.
Mm-hmm. Colored by Glynis Oliver. I'm only a couple issues in, but so far it's a real trip.
Had you not read this?
No.
Oh, that's fun. Oh,
yeah. Cool. Yeah. Oh, I felt like I was like discovering something that no one's ever heard of before. I didn't know that it was like a well-establishedly awesome thing. Yeah. The fourth wall breaking is really fun. And it's done in a playful way that was different than what I was expecting. It's not just mugging for the camera. There's like notes from the creative team and like She-Hulk's directly talking to Byrne by name a bunch or like there's an action scene and they cut away. And when they go back, She-Hulk's just like sitting there and like, oh, now you're back. I can like do the stuff. And she's like, she's like constantly referring to the issue number that stuff happened. It's a character named Wheezy. That's great. And who knows, she's a supporting character, but she also used to be the blonde Phantom. Which I looked it up. That's a timely comics character. Mm-hmm. So you're like your Gwenpool comics and your Deadpool comics. They like owe a ton to this book. The art style it hits that like right on the cusp of 90s sweet spot. So for me, it's like this is what comics are supposed to look like because like that's when I started. You know, in the beginning there were some like interesting kind of light body horror elements to it that were like, maybe that's putting it too grandly, but some very weird things happening there.
Yeah.
I like, given that her like She-Hulk's sweater, but not bra, gets blown to pieces in the first issue and then her head gets removed in issue three. I'm like, I'm assuming it bumps into like classic 90s cheesecake misogyny, but like, I don't know, maybe not. Yeah. It seems tonally closer to like fun Excalibur sex farce style than like
that's my recollection.
Yeah. It seems smarter than like Born Sexy Yesterday tropes or like anything like that. I mean,
yeah,
she's an unstoppable smashing machine and she's smart. She has a legal degree. She's competent. She's funny. So like if the creative team wants to put her in a bikini to fight crime, like that's fine. Like you could do worse, you know, yep. Especially in 1989.
And Bird just uses her to like dredge up just some of the funniest, most embarrassing parts of Marvel history and, you know, like characters that had not been touched since, you know, 1974.
That's great.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Yeah. So like I said, I'm only a handful of issues in, but I was like really blown away right from the jump. It wasn't what I was expecting. And I'm very much looking forward to tearing through it.
Tom, do you have a recommendation for our listeners?
I didn't before coming here, but you know, three of you talked, so that gave me a few seconds to think about what the heck I've read recently that I could put forward. For this crowd and for this podcast, maybe an appropriate thing. It was published small press, but you can get it through Amazon or wherever. Somebody put out a trade paperback that collects the first 25 issues of the Comics Reader, Jerry Bales's 1962 fanzine that sort of previewed upcoming comics and talked about them and so forth. And so it's a super blast from the past as you get to see in real time what he and other super early comic book fans were saying about all this stuff.
Cool.
What they thought about it. It contains 25 issues, although many of those issues, in fairness, were like 2 to 4 pages long. So right. It's not like it's a brick of stuff, but for a comics historian, it's a great little dive into stuff, and because Bales, who was kind of the father of comics fandom, he and underneath him, Roy Thomas and so forth kind of really put this together. He at the time was a college professor, and so you know, rather than being a snot-nosed kid or an 8-year-old or something, so you know, he very quickly established rapport with most of the big comic book editors and creators of the period. Stan would write him letters telling him stuff what was coming up, and he and Julie Schwartz would visit, and he would get inside information on stuff. And so he's a very key individual in the history of comics that most people don't know about.
I don't.
And so it's a you know, it's a volume that's just chock full of stuff like this. You know, Stan Lee's coming out with a new book called The Hulk. We asked for Captain America back, and this is what we get. sorts of things. You know, again, it's for a very rarefied audience, and it's you know, that's why it's you know, boutique published. But you know, if you're interested in this stuff, you know, there's worse ways you can spend your $20 or whatever it is.
Cool. That's fantastic. I had no idea that was out there. I'm very excited to hear that.
Yeah, I just found it because it showed up in one of my feeds one day. Like somebody, it just scrolled up. I had no idea anybody was working on it or was coming or whatnot, but somebody showed, hey, I just got the this, and I went, you got the this? Where did you get the this? How can I get me the this? And then I got the this, and I was happy.
No. Yeah.
Well, that's fantastic. Thank you so much for that recommendation. And Tom, thank you so much for spending time with us once again to talk about Marvel on its 10-year anniversary.
Yeah.
Very cool to have you here.
It's all downhill from here. 50 years of nothing.
Just crickets.
Yeah. I do hope that talking about a month of Marvel history where the powers that be decided to double all the page counts didn't cause you to have any nightmares. Is there anything that you are up to that you would like us to make our listeners aware of, perhaps a Substack newsletter or something?
As you say, yes. You know, a month or two ago, I jumped on the Substack bandwagon,
yeah,
like everybody else in the world, apparently. And so I've been sending out a weekly Substack newsletter of stuff I think of about old comics and current comics I'm working on and things other people have worked on and TV shows I've watched and all sorts of blather. It's all free. There's no subscription fee or anything, and there's not going to be because I have a job and I don't need the money that badly. So anybody that wants to you know, look it up over at Substack, you know, under my name, Tom Brevoort, you know, is welcome to check it out. All of the existing issues are there, and you know, if you sign up, they will be sent directly to your email box without you having to do anything. Although apparently, if you have Gmail, I often write longer than the Gmail limit. So you have to go to the actual Substack place to get the rest of the message. So I'm going to figure out a way to use that somehow. Like I'll craft a murder mystery, but I'll put the killer's identity at the very end so that people will then have to come and check out the site on the site.
I'm signing up right now, and this will be my first Substack, so I will always remember this day.
I might have to do that too. I'm still just getting, you know, the Tom Brevoort experience just sent constantly in my mailbox. I finally had to go to like a weekly, because I was doing it daily and I was spending a lot of what should have been work time reading and looking at pictures of old comics creators, and yeah, it was great.
There's a lot of stuff there, and that still gets updated pretty regularly on a weekly basis. And obviously, there's a link from one to the other. So if you go to the Tom Brevoort website, tombrevoort.com, there's a link there where you can sign up to the newsletter. And if you look at the newsletter, there's a link there where you can go to the webpage and you can find all the other things that I do. Whatever the heck they are, whatever weird platform they happen to be on.
I'm guessing so other than that, you would recommend people buy, I don't know, Marvel Comics, something like that. Yeah,
that would be good. Many of the titles that we have spoken of even today, if you perchance wanted to buy an issue of Avengers or Fantastic Four or Thor, I would not be opposed to such an action. Would appreciate it greatly.
Fantastic. And, you know, once you have spent almost all your money on Marvel Comics, we would love it if you would consider popping over to Patreon and subscribing to the thing that we do here for the fantastic price of $4 a month. The address is patreon.com/MarvelByTheMonth. You can get some exclusive content, including an extended version of this episode. You can review us on Apple Podcasts or whatever you use to listen to us. If you'd like some free stuff in the mail, send us a screenshot of your 5-star review with your mailing address to marvelbythemonth@gmail.com. You can find us on Instagram at marvelbythemonth, and marvelbythemonth.com has links to our other social channels as well as our shop. And that is it for this week. So... until next week, my name is Brian Stratton.
I'm Rob Bell.
I'm Jamie Wenger.
And we'll see you next week for next month. Until then, stay safe, stay healthy, and stay inside and read comics.